Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying crisis in Ukraine, where the Russian military is overtly intervening and the Ukrainian military is suffering setbacks. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, joins us for a strategic analysis of the forces at play between the new Russia, asserted by Vladimir Putin, and the old NATO, meeting in Wales this week with President Obama and the other European heads of state in attendance. We'll discuss the failure of the West to understand Putin and a recent essay by Henry Kissinger that argues America's principles, quoting, need to be paired with recognition of the reality of other regions, histories, cultures, and views of their security. Then we'll look into the political crisis in Pakistan caused by street protests headed by the cricket star turned politician Imran Khan and an obscure Canadian Sufi cleric that has the beleaguered Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif turning to the army, who are likely behind the chaos that they are stirring up. Christine Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and the author of the new book Fighting to the End, Pakistan's Way of War, joins us to discuss this latest orchestrated coup by Pakistan's army to assert its control over foreign policy and perpetuate their disproportionate share of the economic pie in a country that does not so much have an army as an army that has a country. Then finally, we will speak with an expert on the Arab media about how ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, use the media in a way that recruits fighters from the West while intimidating its enemies and promoting its claim of a caliphate. Marwan Krady, the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss the symbolism of beheading Americans in orange jumpsuits and how the black flag of ISIS has expropriated the universal message of Islam that resonates amongst Muslims worldwide. And joining us now, Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And your old boss, Henry Kissinger, had an interesting piece recently in the Wall Street Journal calling for the assembly of a new world order. And some of his conclusions he came to seem to be fairly appropriate to what's happening, particularly in Ukraine. I spoke yesterday with a Russian military analyst who pointed out that the West and the Americans simply don't get it as far as Putin goes, that Putin will simply do anything to prevent Ukraine falling under the Western orbit or the European orbit and under NATO, and he will continually destabilize it. And now we see NATO's leader has just pointed out that Russia is intervening overtly militarily and the Ukrainian forces are suffering setbacks as a result. Here you have Putin's calibrated response, you know. Putin spoke the other day at a youth camp, Nashi, this is this Hitler youth group that he's put together as a form of his support. He talked about Nova Russia, New Russia, and he really is going back to the kind of Tsarist era. I think people mistake him as a communist or a Soviet imperialist, but he's actually a Tsarist imperialist. But what I thought was interesting is that apropos what the Moscow analyst said yesterday, that Kissinger's more or less saying the same thing. I'm quoting him, the celebration of universal principles needs to be paired with the recognition of the reality of other regions, histories, cultures, and views of their security. So do you think anybody in Washington recognizes Russia's view of its own security?
I don't think so, and I think Henry Kissinger has come a bit late to this kind of wisdom. He really did not stand against a lot of the very unwise, destructive diplomacy of the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century. The Clinton and George W. Bush pushing of NATO and of Western interests right up to the Russian border. I mean, we know that a lot of this is reaction to what is perceived in Moscow as the encroachment, the aggression, as they see it, of the West in what was formerly a sphere of influence, clearly for the old Russia. I think you're quite right about the czarist tinge to this. It's a very traditional Russian interest. This is the glossies. This is the buffer zone. This is the, after all, the channel, the avenue through which Russia has been traditionally invaded, and from which they suffered unimaginable casualties in World War II. Now it's a different Europe, and it's a different Eastern Europe, obviously. But much of that. Of that old fear and old concern, obviously, is still there. And when you harness that to the kind of semi-fascist internal politics that Putin practices, the kind of really, I think, proto-dictatorship that he's reestablishing in the Kremlin, it becomes a very destructive force. Henry is very good, as you know, Ian, at constructing these consortia of great powers. He would like to, I'm sure, see some kind of grand settlement that would stabilize and legitimize the order in Eastern and Central Europe. But I'm afraid we're in for a very, very rough ride before that happens.
Well, I think one of the things that Kissinger points out in his Wall Street Journal article, or essay, I guess, that describes the challenge and the disconnect that we're facing here is that the economic system has become global while the political structure of the world remains based on the nation state. The international order thus faces a paradox. Its prosperity is dependent on the success of globalization, but the process produces a political reaction that often works counter to its aspirations. You have a perfect example of that with Putin and these sanctions. On the one hand, he and the Siloviki, the coterie of kleptocrats around him, have their money in the West, but at the same time, they're acting out of their traditional sort of czarist, Russian Orthodox, pan-Slavic kind of impulses, which are at odds with each other.
Well, absolutely, and this is not the old Soviet Union. This is not the world of the 1960s and 70s, or for that matter, the 80s, that Kissinger faced as National Security Advisor and as Secretary of State. I must say, I read this, and I have not read the book from which it is excerpted. I guess that's coming. But I read this with a sense again of Henry, on one hand having learned a great deal, and on the other hand having forgotten nothing. He was quite famously, when I worked for him, and I think it's true in his subsequent books, rather instantly bored by economics, even more so by ideology or religion, passions other than his own for applause. He prefers this sweep of conventional geopolitics, the generalizations and the cliches, the men who mouth them, to the now quite unruly complexity of rapidly changing societies, people in turmoil, especially in the Middle East, especially, but not limited to, the non-white world. Now, this is his old stomping ground, in a sense, in Central and Eastern Europe. This is an area that he knows rather well. He certainly knows it better, and I think probably has a better grasp and appreciation of this than the people around Obama. So we can be, I think, legitimately missing Henry here. But I think what's conspicuously absent, Ian, from this, at least from this op-ed piece, is any real specific recommendation of how we remedy, or how we even begin to remedy this wreckage that he's talking about. you know, his exit from Vietnam, the opening to China, the dickering with the Russians over detente, with the Israelis and the Arabs in the shuttle diplomacy, all those were tasks of the old diplomacy, arms, alliances, frontiers. He did not leave, and doesn't offer any prescription here for Washington in dealing with the reckonings that are buried and are now appearing out of the old Cold War rivalries and the new forces of resource politics, the swelling disparities in wealth, the despoiling of the environment, the collisions of cultures and faiths. I mean, all of that is part of the world, part of the chaos that he bewails at the opening of this piece. But of course, Kissinger spent far more time cultivating the media than he did on understanding the forces of change, even in his own tenure. But this is, I have to say, rather depressing, because I think for all of the limitations and the responsibility that the Kissinger era itself bears for much of what we're seeing, this is more thoughtful in many ways, more structured than anything we've seen out of the White House. You can I think extrapolate from Obama's recent statement that he hasn't got a strategy yet for dealing with ISIS or with for that matter with either Iraq or with Syria, and imagine what these deliberations look like and in the NSC, the NSC staff, et cetera. These are rather small minds compared to what Kissinger, even with his limitations and failures, brought to the table.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. So in terms of Kissinger not coming up with any answers, although he certainly is diagnosing much of the structural problems in a world that where the New World Order was you know, so ephemeral. Neither does, by the way, the critics of the White House. They had a piece, Senators Graham and McCain, the perennial critic, who still saw that he lost the 2008 election. They had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day with John Kerry countering it. It was completely vapid. I mean,
I saw that. I couldn't agree more. You know, what's missing here, Ian, I think on all sides, and it may be the missing ingredient in Kissinger's piece as well, is a genuine sense of responsibility. And by that, I simply mean the responsibility of the United States for the creation and the aggravation of many of the conditions that have led here. I'm not sure that a declaration of that responsibility on something like the early Cairo speech you remember that Obama made about America's role in the Arab world and in the colonial and post-colonial Middle East, something about America's responsibility for the utter failure to construct a stable order, not necessarily a new world order, but a stable order geopolitically and economically in post-Cold War Europe. It wasn't just a matter of reuniting Germany or just a matter of integrating the old Eastern Europe into NATO. It certainly was a matter of bringing the new post-Soviet Russia into the family of nations in a much more constructive, less punitive way than we treated them. Vladimir Putin is the product of external forces as well as the internal disarray in Russia. He's very much the beneficiary of the blundering in Western and American diplomacy. Just of course as Hitler was the beneficiary of Western blunders after Versailles. So this is not a vacuum. It's not a clean slate by any means. And what all of them lack is a sense of that responsibility of what could or should be done now in terms of trying to to reintegrate Russia without this destabilizing revisionism, this attack on the boundaries and the sovereignties of what has emerged. I mean, I have no doubt that the Ukrainians are rather passionate about defending what they see as their territory, and this is the kind of revision, the kind of violence, really, in geopolitical and cultural and ethnic terms that can go on for generations. So we're at a very, very dangerous point, and I don't see the kind of grand strategy or the kind of grand assize that needs to take place. Obama, it seems to me, needs to get on a plane and go talk seriously to Putin and to the interested parties, and of course Merkel in Germany is the key to much of this. The Europeans have to take finally and at last proper responsibility for bringing the Russians in as well. So this is not going to be an easy fix.
Well, Roger Morris, the president is getting on a plane, but he's going to Wales for a NATO conference.
But
this is where I find it sort of somewhat surreal. As you point out, the Ukrainians have every right to want to live their lives the way they want to live them and not live under a kind of gangster state that Russia is offering. And the gangster that Russia had installed there stole the place blind and they finally kicked him out. But on the other hand, you know, Putin is not going to give it up. So this agony will go on. So the questions then go back to, in many ways, back to Chamberlain and Munich. Do you sell out the Ukrainians? And on the other side, NATO, which the military analyst I had on yesterday from Moscow was talking about how the Russian military truly believed that NATO was the enemy, is expanding westward. And I said, well, wait a minute, NATO is a paper tiger. It's a fiction. There are no tanks, American tanks in Germany. So, and he said, well, no, of course it is, but it's the perfect enemy. It's an enemy that doesn't really threaten you, but it allows you to get a huge military budget and put a bunch of stars on your chest, you know?
It's the perfect pretext for the claimants for the budget in Moscow. Just as the new Russian threat, the new Russian menace, which has its share of paper tigerdom, after all, is that for the Pentagon, and always has been. You know what I would like to see, Ian, and I don't really envision this, certainly not in this administration or in any alternative we can imagine. I really would like to see some kind of creative solution, which would allow a face saving of a sort for Putin. The pretext here of protecting the Russian minority in the Ukraine of upholding rights. There are formulas in federal and constitutional reform in the Ukraine that might well accommodate that. There is no reason why a sovereign Ukraine could not live in some kind of cooperative balance with a very powerful Russia, and Putin will not be around forever. This will evolve as a society, but we've got a decade here, it seems to me, at least, in which there's going to have to be very, very creative and a new kind of diplomacy for sorting these problems out. In the end, the new Russia doesn't want a war with the West. A new Russia is as much on the teetering on the brink in several ways, economically, as the West is militarily here in this dispute. It's in no one's interest to see it go on and to fester inconclusively. Certainly not in the Ukrainian interest. But I just don't see the priority being given here. You can't arrive at these kinds of solutions. You can't hammer these things out without very intense and concentrated and serious diplomacy on all sides. And I don't see the engagement of the administration. Now, admittedly, they've got a problem with the collapse of Iraq and the rise of ISIS, and that transfixes the media as it always does in these matters. But the Ukrainian problem is really the central and overwhelmingly important issue of international politics at this point. I just can't see John Kerry or Barack Obama concentrating on anything else until they begin to arrive at a solution with that.
So, Roger Marsh, you were saying that this Ukraine and Russian-American relations are really the 900-pound gorilla here, and we're being distracted by Iraq and Syria, etc. I'm not sure when the president sort of casually says, well, things in what's happening in Ukraine is this, you know, same as before, nothing new is happening at a moment where Russia is militarily intervening overtly. The analyst I spoke with yesterday from Moscow said at this point they don't really want to take that corridor down to, they're ready to, but down to Crimea, but they could escalate that way. But they are going to have a meeting in Minsk. In fact, they're meeting, I think, as we speak. And I think there's an interesting possibility there. The crook that runs Belarus, Lukashenko, apparently, on the one hand, is his people are brainwashed, as the Russian people are, with Russian media, into believing that the Nazis are coming back in Ukraine. But at the same time, apparently Lukashenko himself is kind of shares a lot of what the Ukrainian leader Poroshenko feels, which is, you know, wait a minute, we're sovereign and you guys are invading us. So is there something that can be worked with there, that some of these...
Absolutely. I don't think there is a single state bordering Russia at this point that can take heart or be encouraged by what's happening in the Ukraine. And we have to recognize, too, I think, Ian, that it could be a lot worse. I mean, we're seeing incursions here, as the president calls them, and you remember it was only an incursion in Cambodia. We're seeing long columns of trucks and other vehicles. We're not seeing Russian tanks in force. This could be a lot more sinister and a lot more decisive, but that's Putin's strategy to bleed this thing rather gradually. And of course, there could be a genuine diplomatic coalition, a genuine array of states in Central and Eastern Europe who could come together. It seems to me that again, to sit down and to begin seriously to talk about this, you know, what would a major speech by the President of the United States acknowledging the blunders and the absolutely, from Russian point of view, terrifying and insulting moves toward the Russian border by NATO, acknowledging that there were mistakes made in the past, that sensitivities were ignored, acknowledging that Russia needs to be, can be, deserves to be a major a member of the community of nations in Europe and in the world, something that would I think appeal to the sense of great power status, of pride. This is a country that is recovering from an enormous humiliation. The economic depression and the suffering that they went through after the fall of the Soviet Union and the eclipse of power from a superpower status to in many respects an impoverished and demographically devastated country. My God, their population was aging and failing in a number of ways. The birth rate was down. The future of the country seemed to be dire in a number of respects. They have come back. They've recovered to some extent economically, though it's still very precarious. It's still fragile. Yes, of course, there's a Russian military that will use NATO as far as they possibly can as a pretext for their own politics of budgetary and in the Kremlin. But this is still a nation that wants to be and should be a part of the larger European community, and we did not make that possible. We did not welcome them as we should have, and I think at least the beginning of an acknowledgement of that by the President of the United States publicly, which would mean turning against, of course, the policies of his own administration and of his predecessors, I think would go a long way. But that's just not in the cards. It's not. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of statesmanship that, let's face it, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, for better and for worse, did manage in the opening to China. That was a very, very dramatic moment and a very dramatic reversal of an old policy. It never involved some kind of humiliating admission of guilt by the United States, but it certainly involved in a number of ways explicit and implicit repudiation of the old hostility. And you remember how much Red China was the arch enemy, in some respects even more so than the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s. A country that we didn't talk to, a country that we tried to quarantine and shut off as much as possible. We were trying to covertly assassinate Zhou Enlai right up to the moment when Henry Kissinger sat down to talk with him.
Right, you know,
in Beijing.
I just had dinner the other night with Chaz Freeman, who was Nixon's translator in those secret talks with Zhou Enlai and Mao. Fascinating stories he told. Roger, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, and his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the political chaos in Pakistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. She specializes in South Asian security issues and is a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Council on Foreign Relations, Women in International Security, American Institute for Pakistan Studies, and Combating Terrorism Center. She serves on several editorial boards, such as the Small Walls and Insurgencies and Studies in Conflict and Terrorism. Christine Fair formerly served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, Pakistan's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
And the political chaos in Pakistan is pretty intense, where anti-government protesters briefly occupied the state television network and cut transmission for 45 minutes. They also surrounded the beleaguered Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's residence. The Army Chief of Staff has stepped in, but said on Sunday that there'd be no use of force to resolve the escalating political crisis. And the political crisis, of course, is being caused by the politician Imran Khan, the famous cricket player and a religious leader, the head of the Sufis, who are basically taking to the streets to bring down the government. So, and I remember talking to you some time back, Chris, where you suggested that even Imran Khan himself may have some ties to the Pakistan's notorious ISI, the intelligence service of the army. So can you walk us through the politics, both the overt ones and the covert ones?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think there should be any illusions that that the army is actually behind this. You know, I've recently published a book called The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And, you know, I kind of lay out that in some sense, this is the Pakistan Army's new playbook. The army can't directly intervene by staging a coup, at least right now. And the reason being is that Pakistanis are not really receptive to a coup. And the army has its hands full waging a sort of half-hearted counterinsurgency effort in the tribal areas, and as well as managing and watching what happens in Afghanistan and India. So what the army has had to do, and they've actually been doing this for the last several years, this is actually just a reconfiguration of what they did during the Zardari government. What they essentially do is use these proxies, and in this case it's Tahrir al-Qadri, the Sufi sheikh, self-styled, that you noted, as well as Imran Khan, to engage in these street shenanigans. And the reasons for doing it are pretty straightforward. Nawaz Sharif has been putting a lot of pressure on the army because he's been insistent that President Musharraf be tried for treason. In fact, it's simply a statement of fact that Musharraf committed two acts of treason, which carries the death penalty under the Pakistan Constitution of 1973, which is the constitution that's currently in effect. From the army's point of view, this isn't simply trying Musharraf. It's actually putting on treason trial the entire institution of the army. And any such trial would deter any future army chief from taking over. And the army and Nawaz Sharif are really locking horns over this. The army wants him to be allowed to go. They think he's been humiliated enough. And Nawaz Sharif understands that unless this there is a conviction, the army is not going to be deterred from doing this in the future. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that Nawaz Sharif is very much of his view that there should at least be economic normalization between India and Pakistan. And the army is absolutely furious about this. And they've done everything that they can to slow this process down. So in July alone, there were something like six violations of the ceasefire agreement across the line of control. I've called this in the past basically a slow-motion Cargill. Nawaz Sharif has also been supportive of the idea that Pakistan and Afghanistan normalize relations. Now, these are three things that the Pakistan army is furious with. And so they are doing what they've done in the past, and they did this again or previously in May 2013 when they were trying to put pressure on the outgoing PPP government. But they're basically trying to put Nawaz Sharif in a situation where he can't win no matter what he does. And they've done a really good job of that. So by encouraging these street shenanigans, what they're essentially doing is provoking the government into bringing in the security forces and precipitating violence against the protesters. Then they will charge the government with murder. Now, they've already done this. They've already filed a FIR, a First Information Report, which is essentially a charge sheet against Nawaz Sharif for the murders that these were victims of police brutality that occurred in Model Town about 6 weeks back. And so by embroiling Nawaz Sharif in these legal challenges as well as in these street politics, they're really trying to derail his agenda. They can't bring down this government unless Nawaz Sharif himself falls. Even if he does get mired in these legal battles, he can step down and appoint from within the party another prime minister. But all of this is really aimed at whacking Nawaz Sharif in the knees. And it's quite ironic because he won resoundingly the May 2013 elections. Imran Khan got a pittance of 30 seats. So we should all be really clear that these two fellows are really the marionettes of the army.
So they've got the army and the ISI, I guess, the intelligence service. They have Imran Khan out on the street. And by the way, this Sufi cleric, he's based in Canada, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's in fact, I think, one of the most suspicious characters in all. Your listeners might remember that he sort of splashed onto the scene in the spring of 2013. He came out of nowhere. He even had a suicide bombing proof container box, containerized box that he moved around on wheels. And, you know, you just don't end up in the possession of such a bizarre item without the assistance of the security forces. I mean, I'll point out that even the chiefs of the provincial chiefs of police do not have armored vehicles. And yet this Qadri pops onto the scene essentially with an armored vehicle. Pakistan's politicians, such as the previous parliamentarian Shiri Rahman, who was targeted by the militants for the outrageous claim of blasphemy, was not provided with an armored vehicle. She actually had to procure that herself. So it's really quite suspicious that this fellow comes out of nowhere and he has all of these resources. So I think most cogent observers of the Pakistan Army understand that what we're seeing right now is really a replay of what the Army did in the spring of 2013, and really to very similar effect, which is to constantly cast doubt upon the efficacy of the government. They're putting the government in a situation where there will be use of violence. What Imran Khan supporters did today is a really good example of that. He says that he's encouraging his supporters to be peaceful, but yet they're not engaging in peaceful activities. He has made comparisons to sit-ins that have been conducted in the West, and specifically in the United States. If he thinks this is a sit-in, he needs to look at the dictionary and see what a sit-in is. But what it does seem pretty clear that the Army, no matter what, is going to succeed. There's virtually no chance that people are not going to be killed. They've already been killed. And that this is then going to result in a series of legal challenges. And rather than charging the individual police officers with brutality and use of excessive force, given the political shenanigans that routinely happen in Pakistan, they're simply going to try to charge either the prime minister or the chief minister, who is his brother in the Punjab. And the allegation is that they ordered the police to kill innocent protesters. There's no evidence for that. If there were evidence, then that's a different story. But this is basically the Army's new playbook and how they're going to hobble Nawaz Sharif. What we can potentially expect, what we're talking about a denouement of this crisis, is that Nawaz Sharif finds some convenient cover under which he will let Musharraf leave the country, thereby escaping any possibility of a conviction and quite frankly, a conviction that carries a death penalty from his case of treason, and then acquiesce, as have all previous prime ministers, to letting the army run defense policy and key foreign policies such as that with regard to Afghanistan, India, and the United States, and of course China.
Well, Christine Fairless, so this means that the Nawaz Sharif's only way out, since the army is turning the screws here, using these proxies and surrogates of Imran Khan, the popular tennis player, and this suspicious Sufi sheikh, that the compromise would be to give Musharraf a free pass. But already it's clear, that what you pointed out, is that Sharif's foreign policy initiatives with India, reaching out to India, the army, that's their real agenda. They want to stop that. And they're using military force on the up in Kashmir to stir things up. So that's, at the end of the day, that's the real agenda, right? They want to control foreign policy and have the kind of, well, they want business as usual, right?
they want business as usual. They want to continue having their I don't even know how to describe this without lapsing into terms of derision. They want to continue claiming as if Pakistan has any kind of credible claims on Kashmir. And the fact is they don't. Any sort of moral standing that the Kashmir dispute has really been undermined by Pakistan's use of terrorists to kill not only Indian armed forces, but civilians. Now, this is not to say that the Indians' behavior in Kashmir is acceptable or with regards to international standings, but I would even argue with respect to their own commitments under their own constitution. So when I say that Pakistan has no standing in Kashmir, I am not saying that there is no problem in Kashmir, but what I am saying is Pakistan has no like I stand in that dispute. And of course, the Army's motivation in continuing to keep this dispute alive with India is that if there were to be normalization, the Army could not credibly claim to command the resources that it has, maintain the large conventional posture that it has, or for that matter, be able to run the country whenever it feels like it wants to. So not only is this about essential military equities that, you know, all militaries are kind of invested to one degree or another, and there always being some sort of big bad enemy that they can use to justify access to resources. This is really about a continual justification for an overgrown army that can gobble up the resources per its will, and most importantly, take over the government whenever it feels it's appropriate. So, you know, at the end of the day, Pakistanis really need to hop on the clue bus and realize that Imran Khan is not their savior. This is not a revolution for independence as he's marketing it. This is really two fellows being manipulated by the army so that the army can continue to keep democracy on its leash.
Well, Christine Fair, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. She specializes in South Asian security issues and is a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Council on Foreign Relations, Women in International Security, American Institute of Pakistan Studies, and Combating Terrorism Center. She serves on several editorial boards, such as Small Wars and Insurgencies and Studies in Conflict and Terrorism, and formerly served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, Pakistan's Way of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a specialist on the Arab media about ISIS or the Islamic State's use of the media. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marwan Krady, who is the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture, and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality TV and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Krady.
A pleasure to be with you again.
And clearly the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL are very deft at using social media.
But it does seem that we're confusing. We have so many people, politicians like Senator McCain and others, taking to the television and talking about these barbaric ISIS fighters who have to be bombed, and presidents talked about them as a cancer that has to be removed. But while we're beating our breasts and fulminating about how barbaric ISIS is, they're appealing to their own audience, are they not?
Yes, they are. They have been very savvy at. They've been very adept at exploiting inconsistencies in Western policies and discourses and political behavior, both of Western governments like the U.S., but also the very toxic brew of Middle Eastern politics, the Cold War between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The involvement in Iraq of multiple players, the involvement of Syria in Syria of multiple players, and ISIS has grown very, very quickly. I do think the power of their message is being exaggerated. One of the interesting things is before ISIS, it used to be these are Islamic terrorists, but they have sophisticated media presence. As if you're an Islamic extremist, somehow by definition you cannot be adept at using modern technologies. So that has passed. That kind of speech has passed. And now we're talking about how can we fight them on social media. The problem is, it's probably more, the cancer metaphor is probably more adept to describe their presence on social media. The way they metastasize between, they have official accounts, they have unofficial accounts by members, then actually their physical geographical spread, which is, kind of very predictable and very very non-metastatic, in my opinion.
But what about their own ability to recruit? I mean, the thing that we seem to miss about ISIS in the West is their appeal. We think of them as just as terrorists. But, people are coming, flocking from the West, from the diaspora, to join them. And they have apparently a fairly effective recruiting methods to attract young people. And the fact that they're being successful, of course, feeds on that. They're saying to the potential jihadis in the West, come join us. You know, the train is leaving the station, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of this are the problems of the way immigrants are treated, of the way they behave in Western Europe, right? In countries like the UK, like Belgium, France, especially Germany, Muslim immigrants or the sons and daughters of Muslim immigrants are not treated as first-class citizens. They tend to fall within various zones of exclusion, whether it's social, economic, or cultural. And somehow ISIS has managed to tap, a lot of the extremist Islamist discourse has managed to tap into these frustrations and say, look, we are a community. We don't care about race. We don't care about how much money you make. We don't care whether you're a mechanic or a doctor. What we care about is you're a good Muslim and you want to join the fight against the apostates. And so that discourse does resonate. There's also the fact that they do tap into resentment in these communities against the United States, against the West. And so one of the things that they have done very successfully, if you look at their messaging, whether the videos, the executions, the mass executions, the beheadings, they framed those as tit-for-tat responses to U.S. and Western actions against Muslims in general. So, for instance, if you look, whether it's Nicholas Berg, one of the very first, he was a U.S. contractor who was beheaded in Iraq a long time ago during the days of Zarqawi, during the days of the genesis of ISIS, to the latest, the Foley beheading, they dressed the people they beheaded in orange jumpsuits. Orange jumpsuits are visual responses to Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. This is when Muslims and Arabs first saw people being humiliated, being tortured in orange jumpsuits. And so that not only reminds the audience, their constituency, that, what they are fighting against, but also serves to fuel the anger that in turn helps with their recruitment. If you look at the James Foley beheading, ISIS framed it as a direct reprisal for U.S. airstrike against it in Iraq. They have also been very intelligent at riding global social media bandwagons. So if you look at the Ice Bucket Challenge, right, that's trying to raise money for medical research, we've had at least one, if not two, viral videos of ISIS members drenching themselves with a bucket of blood, right? So they are very adept at taking themes and memes from global popular culture that circulate very quickly on social media and giving them their own bent. And that is very effective because that circulates very, very quickly because it rides on the thing that they're mocking, on the thing that they are satirizing, that they are parodying, and moves as quickly as the initial, the original Ice Bucket Challenge social media meme, which, as you know, has been moving extremely quickly and all over the world. So they're very smart at doing this, at taking advantage of the avenues through which messages circulate globally, the technological platform, but also the cultural frames that seem to work and resonate with global audiences.
But just in terms of, though, of the messaging here, particularly with beheading, and I think your point is really well taken, that the orange jumpsuits are clearly a response to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. But the act of beheading itself is actually quite legal and common in Saudi Arabia. And this is where I think there's a former MI6 officer, Alastair Crook, just wrote a piece saying you can't understand ISIS unless you understand Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. So what's the sense in the Middle East about that connection? Are the Saudis having buyer's remorse about how much they've supported and nurtured these radical groups? Or is there a division within Saudi Arabia between the so-called modernizers in the al-Saud family and the Wahhabi clerics?
Well, the official Saudi position is very much in line with the U.S. position, with you know, the French, German position on ISIS, which is that it's a terrorist group, that any resources that are available to the world must be dedicated to fighting this group. Now, that's the official position. The problem, though, as several commentators have pointed out, including the piece you've mentioned, there's an affinity between the ISIS doctrine, if you can call it that, and Saudi official kind of the clerical political ideology that rules Saudi Arabia, kind of Salafism that's also known as Wahhabism. Now, the problem with that is the following. In a way, it makes the ISIS brand, so to speak, symbolically untouchable. You know, the banner of the group features, you know, there's no God but God and Muhammad is his messenger, which is a declaration of faith of all Muslims. It's in white on a black background. And so what happens is when you fight ISIS, symbolically, it's as if you are fighting Islam at large. We saw it in there's a clothing shop in Istanbul, for instance. The guy has been doing a brisk business selling ISIS clothing, ISIS T-shirts, ISIS hoodies, ISIS bandanas even. And when he was, Western journalists descended on his shop and he said, "Look, I don't know who this ISIS thing is. This is Islamic fashion. It says there's no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger." The man who flew, there was another story in the United States, a man who flew an ISIS flag in New Jersey on his front porch. His neighbors, he became a co-celebre in the U.S. press. He claimed he did not know what it represented, what the flag represented. He just thought it represented Islam. He thought it was an Islamic flag. So going after ISIS is very tricky because it entraps you in a larger symbolic problem where you can be portrayed as an enemy of Islam. So even the Saudi monarchy has to tread carefully. Look at what happened in Lebanon. Lebanon in the last week or so has been in the crosshairs of groups like ISIS and the Al-Nusra Front, which is ISIS's cousin. It's quite ironic that Al-Nusra Front, which is the official Al-Qaeda affiliate, is now portrayed as more moderate, as the moderate Islamist group in the region. But so these guys kidnapped soldiers from the Lebanese National Army, and they've been threatening the Lebanese authorities asking them to release jihadists that are in prison in Lebanon. So a couple of days ago, two teenagers burned ISIS flags. They were not real flags. They were printouts of the ISIS banner. This happened in Sassine Square, a public square in Ashrafieh, which is a Christian neighborhood in Lebanon. So the assumption is that these two kids were Christian. Now, the Minister of Justice, the Lebanese Minister of Justice, immediately fell in a tizzy and announced he was going to prosecute them because they were basically denigrating Islamic symbols. There's no God but God, and Muhammad is God's messenger. So it so happens the Minister of Justice is a Sunni Muslim. Several prominent politicians said, we'll defend these two kids. They're attacking ISIS. They're not attacking Islam. And it inflamed the sectarian tinderbox that is Lebanon. The next day, that was yesterday, ISIS graffiti appeared on two churches in Tripoli, a city north of Lebanon. So you touch their symbol for a very large swathe of the population and politicians, you're touching the symbols of Islam. And that's a very, very big problem.
So, Marwan,
a very, very big problem.
So, Marwan Qureidi, how is are the main television channels dealing with this ISIS or IS phenomenon? Al Arabiya, the Saudi-backed one, and Al Jazeera, the Qatari-backed one.
I haven't been following them too closely. I've watched occasional news bulletins over the last few weeks. The Saudi channel, anything related to Saudi Arabia, is treating them as, you know, these guys are terrorists. But don't forget that for all these channels, they know that there's part of their audience who are sympathizers with ISIS. So the official line is to fight them. But at the same time, you cannot do that too directly and too confrontationally. There is the issue of appearing to attack Islam at large. There's also the fact that now ISIS is the thing that everybody loves to hate. ISIS is a rating booster. If you talk about ISIS, people watch. People are afraid. And so there's these, you know, do you want to reach an audience? And if you want to reach an audience, you need to have more sensational content. Sensational content does not really allow you to have any kind of critical nuance. And what happens is you fuel this panic about ISIS. I have not seen any real analysis of the danger of this group. What you hear very often, this is not true Islam. Well, who decides what is true Islam? That is the question. And so you're really dealing with a sort of a symbolic quagmire when you cover them.
But Al Jazeera,
when they couple.
But I'm saying, in terms of Al Jazeera, which is has always had sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course is being eradicated in Egypt, and my understanding is that they've always, you know, that's what the Saudis hate, is the idea that there's an alternative to their kind of religious dictatorship that they operate. So in terms of the Qataris, how do they see ISIS in terms of their support for the Muslim Brotherhood, which clearly has to be opposed to ISIS and vice versa?
The Qataris don't like ISIS very much because there's some evidence that they support the Al-Nusra Front, which is now a rival to ISIS. And so you have, you know, it's very murky. You cannot tell for sure who's supporting whom. We do know ISIS gets a lot of money from private donors in the Gulf countries, probably including Qatar. But the official line in Qatar is against ISIS. And I don't think ISIS figures in this, you know, the equation of the Saudi regime, the Saudi system, seeing itself as a monarchical kind of Islamist society being threatened by the more republican Islamist model of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, Marwan, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today, but I thank you very much for your analysis. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Qureidi, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and the Director of the Project on Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.